Welcome to Prairie Unitarian Universalist Society. We try to be open and affirming every week, so we welcome you no matter what your beliefs are, what your color of skin is, what your sexual preference is, ethnicity is, we welcome you. Sometimes our services are done by people from outside our congregation, sometimes they are done by lay leaders in the congregation, and sometimes they are done by me, Sandy Pham, Prairie's minister. So if you are new or just visiting us or see how we are, I urge you to come more than one time. I also would like to point out that the title of my reflections this morning should be Grappling with Grace. Although there was a lot of grace in my getting, too. I've done reflections titled Grappling with Grief, and I've done titled Grappling with Greed. So I think I just got my five-letter GR words. These, then, are the opening words. It's a Pueblo song, part of a Pueblo song that I'm not going to sing. But this is for our young people who have been here yesterday, and some of you were here overnight, too. It also goes along with the story for all ages. Everybody, wake up. Open your eyes. Stand up. I knew that. Be children of the light, strong, swift, and sure of foot. Hurry, clouds, from the four quarters of the universe. Come, big snows, that water will be abundant this summer. Come, ice, cover the fields, that the seeds may grow into good crops. All hearts, be glad. These are the words of Denise Levantov, a poet. And so quiet, I don't know when it began. A gratitude had begun to sing in me. Was there some moment dividing song from no song? When does dewfall begin? When does night fold its arms over our hearts who cherish them? When is daybreak? I have two very short readings I would like to share with you this morning. First, from Unitarian Universalist Minister Robert Walsh, a little piece that calls More Than We Deserve. He writes, I heard the second Brandenburg Concerto played in honor of Bach's 300th birthday, and I was swept away. I remembered a story about the people who send messages into outer space. Someone suggested sending a piece by Bach. The reply was, but that would be bragging. Some say we get what we deserve in life, but I don't believe it. We certainly don't deserve Bach. What have I done to deserve the second Brandenburg Concerto? I have not been kind enough. I have not done enough justice. I have not loved my neighbor or myself sufficiently. I have not praised the universe enough to have earned a gift like this. Life is a gift we have not earned and for which we cannot pay. There is no necessity that there be a universe, no inevitability about a world moving toward life and then self-consciousness. There might have been nothing at all. Since we have not earned Bach or crocuses or lovers, the best we can do is express our gratitude for the undeserved gifts and do our share of the work of creation. The other one is by Bart Chatterton's former minister, Robert David Blanchard. His is titled, Getting the Drift of Winter. No one lives in Syracuse, New York for long without finding some way to make peace with winter. Snow is what we manufacture the most around here. It mixes with falling leaves early in November and dukes it out with the daffodils in April.
I know what to expect, yet I am never ready. When I woke up, when I woke to 6 inches the other day, I muttered about in search of gloves and a hat and scraper for the car before starting out to an early appointment. I was lost in thought about possible delays to a flight I was scheduled to take, the need for new tires, the urgency to get the storm windows in place, leaves raked and garden mulch, all the standard winter worries. Then, like a gong awakening me, a snowball splashed against metal. I thought some kids had chosen my car as a handy target, but I soon saw that it was the stop sign that had been hit. I looked around to see the culprit. There he was, grinning broadly, rubbing his hands together in pride over his bullseye. A fellow about 80 years old. He waved, I waved, he smiled, I smiled. I had a feeling he knew something about winter that I could stand to learn. By the time my appointment was over, most of the snow had melted. I had missed my chance to welcome winter. With a little practice, I'll have learned something by April. Grace. Grace is one of those words that free-thinking humanists often don't know how to interpret. What do we even mean by that word? Is there such a thing as grace in the universe? And if so, how does grace impact our daily lives? I have grappled with grace in grief, but wrestled with grace for at least a decade now. More accurately, I have put a lot of energy into trying to reject the idea that grace might have anything to do with my life. As Rebecca Parker says, if we take an honest look at our history, our world, and ourselves, we have to admit that trust in a grace that upholds us all is not at the core of most of our beings. I believe we profoundly doubt grace, concludes Parker. I believe that also, that we profoundly doubt grace. We liberals, that is. We humanists, agnostics, atheists, religious liberals. And yet, I have to admit that I have experienced grace. I grapple and doubt because can't easily fit the concept of grace into the part of my brain that demands I be sensible and logical. I can't make a rational, reasonable case to either prove or disprove that there is grace in the world. I can't give you any scientific evidence that something profound, which is what grace is at work in the world. Robert Walsh's More Than We Deserve reading interprets grace as a gift that we did absolutely nothing to deserve. His example of this is a powerful musical work, but the world is full of other examples. David Blanchard's playful musing on learning to live with winter reminds us that while grace is ever present, it is up to us to acknowledge and accept or reject it. When I'm looking closely at a word, I start with a dictionary, not necessarily a computer dictionary. I still have 3 volumes of a big set. So I go there, and most of the definitions in my possibly outdated Webster's Third New International Dictionary are variations on this one. And I can't even say this word. Beneficence. This is not a word I use often in everyday. Beneficence. Thank you. I was putting the accent in. Yeah. Or generosity, shown by God, capital G, to man. These weren't helpful definitions. Too much God talk from this humanist. Often I use the words love, or universe, or God, which can make some things that I read more palatable. But the idea of a supernatural being out there giving me something isn't particularly useful for this Buddhist-leaning Unitarian Universalist. Nor do I think that these definitions are relevant in the secular world in which we live. My other go-to book, besides the dictionary, that I use when I'm trying to get a better understanding of words that trip us up or push our buttons, is Kathleen Norris's book titled Amazing Grace, A Vocabulary of Faith. Her essay titled Grace is God-centered. Basically, though, a fascinating interpretation of the story of Jacob and his sins, which were pretty awful, some of you may recall, and God's response. There was no punishment, no death sentence for Jacob, but rather, God gave Jacob a blessing. Norris concludes that God chose that reaction to Jacob's wrongdoings because he, God, looked right through that tough little schemer and saw something good, if only a capacity for awe. What a beautiful phrase, completely, totally, absolutely applicable to all of us. We all have the capacity for awe. Grace happens. But I kept looking for a definition of grace that was broader, that had more depth, and didn't depend on the use of the word God, nor use any God language. Well, there's that definition in More Than We Deserve, where Walsh defines grace as undeserved gifts that we did not earn, and we don't have to know from whence or from whom the gifts came. I found this sermon by Unitarian Universalist minister Marilyn Sewell, titled appropriately, Amazing Grace, but I already had mine titled before I found that. Sewell echoes Walsh. Grace is a gift, she says, an undeserved gift that is bestowed upon us out of the bounty of life. It just shows up one day and announces itself to our astonishment, often when we least expect it. It is constant. It's there no matter what we do. Rebecca Parker, Unitarian Universalist minister, president of Star King School for the Ministry, and one of the most respected theologians in the world right now, turns to the universalist side of our heritage to ponder what grace is. And to do this, she goes back to the 1800s, when universalism was one of the largest denominations in the United States. Its doctrine of universal salvation and its insistence that a loving God would never condemn anyone to everlasting hell made it a very popular religion. Grace was a keystone of universalist theology. It's hard to see how you could have universal salvation without grace. Parker writes, universalist interpretations of universal salvation are varied, but I believe all of them can be read as an effort to give expression to a deep religious intuition that all of our lives are unquestionably grounded in grace. There is a gift that is given to all people and embraces the whole of creation, a gift that does not have to be earned, that will never be lost, and that cannot be taken away. Well, there's not time this morning to delve into universalist theology and the connection between the universalist belief in universal salvation and grace and a loving God, or universe, if you will. But it's worth noting that Herman Bisbee, a universalist minister, was tried for the crime of heresy in 1872, the only time in our history when we had a heresy trial. And he was tried for heresy partly because of what he said about grace in a sermon he gave in March of 1870. In natural religion, there is no gift, Bisbee wrote. Salvation does not come by grace. Well, as Parker says, perhaps this is the essence of heresy for a universalist, the denial of grace. Then Parker continues with this astounding statement. Perhaps this denial still troubles the relationship of universalism and Unitarianism. Think about that. Perhaps the Unitarian tendency to deny grace or anything that can't be proven still troubles the relationship of Unitarianism and universalism. Well, I think she's on to something here. We half-jokingly describe Unitarians as operating from their heads, but rarely from their hearts. And then we flip it and say, half-jokingly, that universalists certainly acted out of their hearts, but rarely from their heads. Those early 19th century Universalists weren't anti-intellectual, but they were, I would venture to say, more well-rounded theologically than the Unitarians. They usually were more likely to take intuition and experience into account, and not just their head. You know, they would look at theological questions from all perspectives, their experience, their intellect, their emotions. Well, now I'm getting into mystical territory, which I find intriguing and exciting. We are here to fall in love, not just intellectually, but also with our emotions and feelings, with our heart and body, with our whole selves. We have to fall in love with creation, with life, maybe even throw in some Sufi dancing or some celebrating of the dawning day. Truly grasp what grace is all about. Soul puts it this way: we are enveloped in grace, completely caught up in love, in the same way that we are surrounded by the air that gives us life. We are quite literally in love. But this is hard to understand. This love is unconditional, and there's no way it's going away. We can't feel it at times because we're alienated from ourselves and others and the universe. Sometimes, concludes Soul, as St. Augustine said, our hands are too full to receive the grace that is offered because our lives are too busy. So Soul's expressing much of what I grapple with. And as I said, we're not just getting into mystical territory, we're getting into the important big theological questions. What is the meaning of life? Why are we here? Who are we? Why do good things happen to the other way? Why do bad things happen to good people? And so we can ask the other part too. How could a loving God let us make such a mess of things? Does everything happen for a reason? Does anything happen for a reason? It doesn't matter if you use the word theological or not when pondering these conundrums, so don't get hung up on that. These are logical questions that thinking people eventually ask. And here's another big question. Where is love? I ask this question not because it's 2 weeks or 3 weeks from Valentine's Day, but because for me to accept that grace is real and profound and a factor in our lives would mean that I would also have to accept that we are held in this lifetime, on this planet Earth, in this universe, by an all-encompassing love, despite everything bad. Love is right here, waiting for us to act on this fact. Who can believe in this kind of love, and thus believe in grace, and still live in this world? This world that is such a mess, full of horrible things, and unbelievably sad happening. So, I grapple with grace, even as I continue to find examples of grace everywhere. Many of you know that I've spent the last several weeks grappling with some kind of bug, a dragon, cold, flu, something. Grace has appeared in the form of health returning. I am hardly coughing at all. Now start coughing. My energy levels are getting back to normal. And a few days ago, I was euphoric. I was high most of the day. And just the thought of being alive. And no, I wasn't on drugs. Grace happens. Or how about that meteor that exploded over Binsk city in Russia? In February of 2013, it apparently had the power of 40 Hiroshima-style atom bombs. Thousands of windows were broken. Some people were temporarily blinded. Over 1,600 people were injured. No one was killed in this city of 1 million people. Grace happens. Last week, one of you, and you, told us about not being able to stop a car at a stop sign. And T-boning a truck, I believe.
Another car.
And you weren't hurt?
No.
Grace happens. Marilyn Sewell tells this story about grace. One time I did a very foolish thing. I've done lots of foolish things, she said. But this was a dangerous and foolish thing.
When my boys were 10 and 11, they spent the summer with me in Berkeley, where I was studying. They asked to go up on the roof of the apartment building and play. A new friend of theirs was visiting, a little girl about their age. So I told the three of them, okay, they could go. I knew the wall around the roof was fairly low, but I reasoned that they were responsible enough to handle being there alone. After about half an hour, I called them to dinner, thinking everything was fine. It was 2 days later that my children confessed what had happened. Their new friend, who apparently was a sort of daredevil, had stood up on top of the wall and walked the narrow rim around the roof garden 7 stories up. She didn't fall, but I still have fantasies about that child and what could have happened and what I would have had to live with. For me, it was a great act of grace that my misjudgment did not lead to disaster. Grace happens. On my most recent trip into the Grand Canyon, just a few weeks ago, I rounded a bend on a trail in a box canyon and came face to face with a deer.
A big deer.
A buck. All these points. My hunter friends would have been ecstatic. 6 feet away from me. There were no other people around, and there was no place for me to go. It's called a box canyon for a reason. There's a creek on one side with a very steep slope down, and there's a cliff, the canyon side here, on the other side. So I backed up slowly, and the buck kept walking towards me, and making eye contact. And then the buck suddenly found a place that he could get down to the stream, and I quickly left. Grace happens. Now, I suppose a case could be made that these are all examples of luck, not grace. But for reasons I have trouble explaining, I am not willing to concede that it was just luck. Of course, I'm not willing to attribute these stories to divine intervention either. Hence my grappling. But no, countless stories of grace that have nothing to do with luck. The Olympics, for example. I have friends who don't like the Olympics, and relatives who don't like the Olympics, for any number of reasons, often political. But I admire and respect the Olympians for seizing the opportunity to show us what grace looks like when it is literally embodied in, well, a body. Being open to the possibility of grace can be scary and risky and probably a little crazy. You have to fall in love with this world, despite all the pain and sadness and gloom and doom. Now, don't get me wrong, this isn't supposed to be a feel-good sermon. For a humanist or anyone, to accept the fact of grace requires toughness, a suspension of belief, a letting down and a letting go of our defenses, allowing and encouraging ourselves to be vulnerable and open to the mystery and the awe of the universe. It requires that we sometimes back away from rationality, reason, logic, and from having to have life defined always and only in these terms. Maybe we're missing something, or maybe we've lost something. Is it possible that between our Unitarian heritage, which encourages us to use our intellect, our rational selves, and ignore so many of the other aspects of being human, is it possible that this heritage, in combination with our electronic gadgets, is it possible that this combination keeps us ever more removed from the world? And there's a cultural expectation in play here too, I think, above and beyond our faith tradition. A cultural expectation that assumes that eventually humans will be able to explain everything, and by implication to ultimately control everything. Well, that assumption doesn't seem to have worked very well over the last couple of centuries. Rebecca Parker says that our universalist ancestors from the 1800s who thought that the loving spirit will bring about happiness and holiness for all seems naive in a world that has seen the gas chambers of World War II, too many genocides, too many school shootings, too much violence. How can we believe in grace? Woody Allen makes a good point when he says, if there is a God, clearly, this God is an underachiever. We have lost track of grace. We don't understand it. We probably don't even think much about it. Grace is constant.
always there, just fail to recognize its presence. Is that because we are too removed from the real world? Are we too alienated from our whole selves and each other and the universe, also called love or God? And the more removed we are from the world, then doesn't that make it easier to destroy it? Unthinkingly, whether with bombs and drones in faraway countries or through our inability to take proper care of the environment or our unwillingness to share the wealth of the world by fixing our broken inner cities or recognizing what is happening in our prison populations. We humans have the capability to mend much of what is broken in our world. We need fresh ideas, new ways of thinking. We need grace. Grace can enter our lives at any time, but perhaps it shows up most often when we are in the midst of grief, sorrow, despair, pain. We can be open to the possibility that it will enter our lives, but we can't will it into our lives. It finds us, not the other way around. One last story about grace, a story told by Rebecca Parker. She writes, "It had been a year of grief. In a situation of broken love, I chose to have an abortion. I felt it was the only thing I could do. But I was haunted by the loss of that surrendered child. My grief deepened as days passed. Time was not healing my sorrow, and I spiraled deeper and deeper into despair. By day," and at this point in her life, Rebecca Parker was a Methodist minister. She has dual fellowship. "By day, I would dutifully and to all appearances cheerfully perform my responsibilities as the minister of a small and vibrant congregation. But at night, I couldn't sleep. I'd rise, pace the empty halls of the parsonage and wail. My despair and isolation came to a crisis one night. I was past living one day at a time, or even one hour at a time, and was down to the question, the deep philosophical and theological question of whether I would be willing to continue to live at all. In the depths of that sadness, I decided to stop pacing the hall. It was after midnight. I left my house and walked down the hill to Lake Union in Oakland. The city was quiet. My face was wet with tears as I set my course toward the water's edge. I was determined to walk into the lake's cold darkness and find there the consolation that I could not find within myself. At the bottom of the hill, the street ended and the lakeside park began. I walked across the wet grass and climbed the last rise before the final descent to the water's edge. As I crested the rise, I discovered a line of dark objects between me and the shore, a barricade I was going to have to cross to get into the water. I didn't remember this barricade being there before. It was so dark that I couldn't tell what I was seeing. But as I edged closer, I discovered it was a line of human beings hunched over some strange-looking, spindly equipment, telescopes. It was the Seattle Astronomy Club. There they were, with their homemade Heathkit telescopes and their top-of-the-line sharper image telescopes, dressed in their Gore-Tex backcountry gear and tennis shoes, a club of amateur scientists up and alert in the middle of the night because the sky was clear and the planets were near. To make my way to my death, I had to get past an enthusiast in tennis shoes. He assumed I'd come to look at the stars. "Here, let me show you," he said, and began to explain the star cluster his telescope was focused on. I had to brush the tears from my eyes to look through the telescope. There it was a red-orange spiral galaxy. Then he focused it on Jupiter, and I peered through to see the giant glowing planet. Could not bring myself to continue my journey in a world where people get up in the middle of the night to look at the stars. I could not end my life. I know there is grace, Harper says, because my life was saved by the Seattle astronomer. I have never experienced anything quite that dramatic in my life, but I have been saved more times than I can count with my encounters with pelicans, with sunsets, with incredibly exquisite trees, with northern lights, once by a loon who was swimming a few feet away from me, once by finding myself suddenly in the middle of a herd of elk, and even by that scary encounter with the deer last month. I have encountered grace. It doesn't matter whether or not I can logically explain it. I want to learn to trust grace. The world is too big, too mysterious for any one of us to grasp everything. Sometimes I can be incredibly graceless. I was on the square a few days ago, Capitol Square, and I always sort of adopt a homeless person. I did this in San Francisco too. I have one person that I talk to a lot, and I usually give them a buck or two. And it was cold, it was cold. And we were chatting, and then I ran an errand, and I came back, and I said, "Bill, you should go home." I said this to a homeless man. "You should go home. It's so cold out." I felt, as you can imagine. And a friend of his was standing beside him. They cracked up. They thought this was hysterical. And I apologized. And then there's that bumper sticker on the back of my car, and my inability to live up to it in, so many occasions. It's right there in the back of my car. It must be true. It says, "Grace happens." But I often forget that it's there and that I'm supposed to be an agent of grace rather than muttering nasty words at a rude driver. It's up to me to accept the challenge that grace presents and to act accordingly, though I'm often not sure what this means. Who can believe in this kind of grace, and by extension in this kind of love, and still live in this world? This world is a mess, full of horrible things and unbelievably sad happenings. Who, though, cannot believe in grace? How can we not trust that there is grace at work in the world? Grace brings us back to the world. Grace gets us through the cold night. The gift of grace surrounds us. Do we accept it or do we reject it? I think we are called to give back to the world, to embody grace, to be instruments of grace. And in the middle of our trials, our tribulations, our traumas, and our tragedies, we are called by the universe and by that interdependent web to accept grace, to find the place of primal thanksgiving. Despite everything, grace happens. Slightly longer bunch of closing words by Greta Crosby. Let us not wish away the winter. It is a season into itself, not simply the way to spring. When trees rest, growing no leaves, gathering no light, they let in sky and trace themselves delicately against dawns and sunsets. The clarity and brilliance of the winter sky delight. The loom of fog softens edges, lulls the eyes and ears of the quiet, awakens by risk the unquiet. A low, dark sky can snow. Emblem of individuality, liberality, and aggregate power. Snow invites us to contemplation and to sport. Winter is a table set with ice and starlight. Winter dark tends to warm light, fire, candle. Winter cold to hugs and huddles. Winter wants to gift and share it. Winter danger to visions, plans, and common endeavoring, and the zest of narrow escapes. Winter tedium to merrymaking. Let us therefore praise winter, rich in beauty, challenge, and pregnant negatives. Let it be so. Greet your neighbor and eat some soup.